none of the embryos had made it to day 5. And that was a destroying phone call for both of us. My results came back and the exact words were, morphology is very low, motility is very low. It was a very scary moment. My biggest regret from the whole fertility journey was that ostrich moment right at the beginning, that time that was wasted.
Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. We are joined by another amazing Nexus Fertility community member today in James Cowley. How are you, buddy?
I'm really well, thanks. How are you guys?
Good, all the better for having you here. Thank you for being willing to come here and share your story. It means so much to us.
Yeah, it really does. And you know, we know a little bit about your story, and you know, the listeners of this pod are going to get so much out of it. So thank you so much for coming on. I guess we better jump straight into it. What was the first step in your fertility journey?
Yeah, my wife and I, we've been trying to conceive now for four and a half years. Unfortunately, I did the usual male thing of burying my head in the sand, the ostrich moment, as we all seem to do from listening to the pod. So about 6-9 months in, nothing was happening. Laura, my wife, she went and got tested and everything came back clear. 6-9 months later, that was when I took the plunge and got tested, as I say. The ostrich moment, head in the sand. You always get told when you're at school, you know, it's just going to happen. Don't have unprotected sex. You will end up pregnant. You will end up with a child. That is just it. We all just assumed that that was what was going to happen. That's what I did. And that's what I assumed anyway. You never think that it's going to be you. That's the problem. So it took 2 samples for me to get confirmed, which as me being the issue, which seems to be normal. But what happened was after the first one, I got a phone call from the GP saying, oh, there's been a mix-up with some of the results. Need to have a second sample. So about 2-3 weeks later, I ended up going and producing another sample. For those who are listening who are in York, it isn't the best place to go and have a sample. You've got this room that's in the middle of the ground floor. The andrology lab is round the corner and up some stairs. So you have to go and buzz and they come down and show you the room. That's great, and show you where to put the sample at afterwards. Some lovely NHS horrendous fluorescent strip lighting really to set the mood off. Some pleather wipeable sofas just for you to sit on. Just really what you want. Sets the mood, puts you right in that frame of mind. And the first time I had to produce a sample there, the andrology assistant actually, or the lab tech actually stayed outside the room because it was so far away, waited for me to produce my sample and put it in the little room, sorry, the little box with the call button, and then for me to leave for them to go in and collect it. And I didn't realize what was going on at the time. And I was a bit like, afterwards, would be like, that's a bit weird. That is weird. The second time, that didn't happen at all.
Did you know they're outside whilst you were in there?
No, they said that they'd just be round the corner. And I thought that they would be going back to the lab. And I opened the door and they were stood there. And it was a bit like, oh, okay. Weird. That's how to put a bit of pressure on. I think in the Nexus forums, they call it wanxiety. I'm glad I didn't realize. That's all I'm going to say.
I've had times where I could hear them like in a staff room or reception area or something, and that was bad enough. But the thought of having someone waiting up, which obviously you didn't know at the time, but then did it play on your mind the next time?
The second time I went there, I got, so it was about 45 minutes, 50 minutes from home. I got there and I realized I'd forgotten the sample pot. So you've booked the room for a set time and all the rest of it. I get there, I'm like, fuck. So I go cap in hand, a bit like Oliver, please, sir, can I have some more? It was, please, do you have a spare pot? And then can I have a label to put on it as well and all the rest of it? So they did and it was fine. But that second time they weren't there, they disappeared off. Great, fine, not a problem.
Yeah, ideal. Yeah. In a less than ideal scenario, but that's, I think a bit of privacy isn't too much to ask for.
That's what you think, right? So that was when it was confirmed that I have, it's something that it translates as weak, slow and malformed sperm, which is always lovely to hear when you do the Google afterwards, but it's a horrendous thing to pronounce. So I'm an engineer by trade and I often say, look, just tell me things in a nice, simple way. I'm just a simple engineer. It's nice and easy for me, all right? And this is one of the times where I'm like, I cannot pronounce this. I'm going to give it a go for the listeners. Asthenoteratozoospermia, which, as I say, translates as weak, slow, and malformed sperm. So I've got low motility, low morphology, and ultimately, yeah, very low chance of naturally conceiving. So my morphology, the highest I ever got was 3% without it being prepared. There was a time where I had the 0% normal forms. And then when it was all spun up, it came out maximum at 5% morphology. So I was a prime candidate for ICSI straight away. And from that point on, there was little, I would say no investigation for me in my fertility journey and the resultant effect IVF and ICSI. So we've had 2.5 rounds of failed IVF through ICSI across 2 clinics. So the first one was in Hull, and unfortunately my wife did have a not so good experience there in terms of the conscious sedation. It was nurse-led rather than anaesthetist-led, so it unfortunately she was one of the few who it really didn't work for. And then we had another round, so the outcome of our first round, we did have day 5 embryos. Unfortunately, one was good enough to implant, the other one wasn't good enough to freeze. We implanted our day 5, and unfortunately it didn't take. My wife also had OHSS symptoms on the run-up to that, or post-implantation and post-egg retrieval, so that was another challenging point. Middle of the summer, blazing heat and having to be all compression socks and the rest of it to reduce the potential swelling and clotting. So for our second round, we moved clinic to Create in Leeds.
Was there a reason why you moved?
We didn't have, because of Laura not having a great experience at the first clinic, we lost confidence when we asked them about what they would do differently. So Laura has PCOS, and ultimately it was nothing. And especially with the feedback on the nurse-led sedation and the effects that had on Laura, we wanted to move somewhere where there was an anaesthetist doing the sedation and looking specifically for deep sedation as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So looking around the area, Create in Leeds was one who had ticked all the boxes, reputable, reasonably close, about 45 minutes, an hour away from where we live. And that's why we chose it. And it was a really good experience. Like, all the clinical staff and the receptionists, they were really nice and friendly, really supportive when Laura was recovering from the egg retrieval process, really supportive through bouts of nausea and getting her on her feet. And Laura ended up with some pain as well. So they were great. They really supported her. And we had the egg retrieval on the Friday. And on the Saturday, we were expecting the phone call to tell us how many eggs were mature, how many had fertilized, and therefore we could set ourselves up for the day 3 position and then ultimately the day 5 position. I was going out to get breakfast for us. So I got up early, disappeared off into town, and went and got pastries. So you always have this picture in your mind's eye. It's always going to be this round. That's something that I firmly believe in. You never go into a round thinking it's not going to be this time. You always think it's this time. It's going to be this time. It's going to be the perfect round. And I got back and Laura was on the phone, unhappy. You could see it in her face. And we hadn't had the number of mature eggs that we were expecting, and we hadn't had the fertilization rates at all. And that started a bit of a doom spiral for us both. We did still have breakfast, and we didn't want to waste the pastries. You don't want to try and make the most of it. But at the same time, we were both down. And I remember taking the dog for a walk. So we've got a working Cocker Spaniel, and I took him for a walk, and I remember standing in the middle of the field, and I just threw my head back and I screamed into the ether, because it just felt like this was another round, another fail. The fuck have we done wrong? What have we done to deserve this? This just didn't seem fair. And it was spring weather for this, so it was that sort of slight grey coolness, misty rain sort of thing. So real dramatic. If you wanted to make a film of it, that was the sort of mood and the vibe that was going on for the day anyway.
Yeah, the weather matched the mood inside.
Oh, yeah.
Perfectly. Yeah.
And then we got the phone call on the Monday to say that actually we'd got a decent position for our day three embryos. So all of a sudden that lifted us up again. We were both at work. We were working from home. And I said, things are going to happen. Worst case scenario now, we've got one frozen. We've got something in the bank. And so I then went back to work. I travelled down to work the next day. So I was working in Birmingham at the time. So it was about 2 hours away. And on that Wednesday, Laura got a phone call to say that none of the embryos had made it to day five. And that was a destroying phone call for both of us. Absolutely destroying. I took some time to process it by myself and eventually then got in the car and I went back to see Laura, which was absolutely heartbreaking. I'd asked my mum to go and see her as well as I was on my way back, just so that Laura had someone there. And I think that helped, but there's a big part of me that wish I didn't go to work that week. I also needed something to take my mind off it. That's been a theme throughout for me. So if I wind back to when I first heard about the fact that when I was first diagnosed with male factor infertility, I was at work this time. I was working in Peterborough, so that was 2.5 hours away from home. 136 miles door to door, 2.5 hours. I was commuting that 3 to 4 days a week. So I was in a stressful environment doing that on the road at about 5:30 every day, back home at about 8 o'clock in the evening.
Wow.
And I was lucky that my phone call came from a GP. So I can remember it really clearly. I was in work. I'm a civil engineer by trade, on-site PM at the time. And I was out seeing one of the remote offices that we had. And I had the phone call and I was in a site cabin. I've got lads milling around everywhere, not really any private space. So I answered her, I said, look, give me a second, I need to go to the car. So I jumped in the car, put it on the hands-free so I could take notes at the same time. And it was in the middle of summer, blaring heat. Couldn't have aircon on because I needed to listen to what was being said. Windows up to try and limit what other people could hear. And you're there sweating profusely just in the heat. And then obviously with what you're about to hear, because it could be life-changing or it could not be. And it was about 2 o'clock and I was told, my results came back and the exact words were, morphology is very low, motility is very low, so you're going to need some help and support with the fact that you've got male factor infertility.
What did those words mean to you at the time, like morphology and motility? Do you remember your reaction to those?
Yeah, so I've heard a lot of people on the podcast say things like they just heard white noise when things were said. I think it's slightly different to that. So I went numb. I didn't know how I felt, what I felt, what that meant to me. How was I going to deal with it? All of these things were circling through my head. Obviously, I knew what the words motility and morphology meant. And I also knew that my year 9 biology had taught me that IVF was the process that we would go through and would be able to fix that. So I went back to work. So that day, after it happened, I called my wife, I told her, and then I went back to work. Because at the end of the day, the result's there then. I can't do anything about it. I've got things that are happening here and now, so I had to deal with that. And then I went home, 2.5 hours driving home. With that as the only thing that's swirling around in your mind, it's painful, it's challenging.
What was going through your mind?
What was it going to mean for me? What did it mean for us? How were we going to recover from it? Were we ever going to be able to have a child? Is IVF and ICSI the way forward? Didn't know much about ICSI at the time. And that was something that came later, but it was a very scary moment. And part of me felt that was a defining moment. What was I going to do about it? And at the time, it was very little. I was going to do nothing. Someone at work who, he was a bit of a mentor for me. We went through a bit of a rough patch at work, and he said, "You need to be more your true, authentic, vulnerable self, James. I see it, but other people don't." So I used to pride myself on being this sort of automatron that would just keep on going. If there was a problem that needed to be fixing, fix it. Work all the hours God sends just to deliver. I used to wear that as a bit of a badge of honour. And it was in that moment that I realised that wasn't going to be the badge of honour. Things had completely changed in the workplace and how people operate. No one needs to see and respect someone who just works all the time. They need to see that there's a human behind that steel outer shell.
And what is that authentic, vulnerable version of you?
So that's who now. I'm someone who I wear things on my sleeve. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I am an empathetic person. I try and understand what goes on with people. It's not all about just delivering that end result. It's about making sure that we understand what's going on and how we can play people to their strengths at work and how we can understand what that means. From a work perspective, that's me. Personal perspective, pretty similar. I care about everyone in my life. I want them to be well and okay. Sometimes to the detriment of myself, but that's who I am. And that's what I wanted to try and get across to people. So I started talking about it very early on, the fact that we were going through fertility challenges. And it was Laura said, "Look, everyone's is going to wonder what is going on with fertility and our fertility. And we are of that age now, you get the questions asked." And I was very open and said, "Oh, I'm fine. I've understood that now. It's part of me. It doesn't necessarily define me." But there's a big societal pressure these days that any fertility issue is always badged at women and the female partner. And neither of us wanted all the pressure to be one or the other of us, be it forced pressure or societal pressure or just how we operated together. So I always opened things with, "Oh, we've got male factor infertility." And I used to joke and say, "I'm the problem." It was always going to be me, just to try and lift the mood a bit, try and get people to think a bit more outside the box about it. People have always pinned it on the women, and it takes two to tango. As your pod has shown, there's lots of people out there who have this, but you don't need to let it define you. You can let it just be part of you. So that's what I try to embody throughout all of this.
You talked about like being okay with it now and like comfortable with it. So how have you got to that point where you're like, "This is the way it is and I'm comfortable with it"?
Yeah, so it took probably 3 or 4 months for me to get to that point where I felt I could. That was when I started talking to my mentor about it and stuff as well. So it wasn't just a 2.5 hour drive home and I was there ready to talk. 3 or 4 months, and it was about the time that we actually managed to get through the referral process for our first round of ICSI. And it was the point where we were referred and accepted that I needed to be able to tell people at work, because I was about to take time off for various appointments, things that were going to happen. I didn't want it just to be questioned why I was disappearing, why I wasn't showing up. So that was the first catalyst. And that then got me to talk to my mentor about it. And that really was then the catalyst for further development for me. And I would say I'm still not fully there, even though I talk about it all the time. I'm very open. I was talking to people this morning about recording a pod and explaining about what I was doing. I'm still not there to a point where I'm fully au fait with it, but I'm a lot further along the process of understanding that than I would be if I just buried it and stuffed it down. I've got some autoimmune conditions as well that I've had all my life, and they presented themselves during my teenage years, and once again they became something that it was just part of me and I had to understand it rather than anything else. And I've tried to treat infertility as in the same way, because I'm still here, I'm still me, it hasn't changed who I am physically. It's probably made me a better person emotionally and more mentally resilient. I don't like the word journey, just like you guys don't. So I say everything that we go through is character building. This is just adding a little bit more character. And at some point, the universe is going to say, James, you've got enough character. You can fucking stop having these things thrown at you. But until that point, I'm still here. I'm still pushing on with it. And everyone's got, without being too cliched, everyone's got their own cross to bear. Yeah. Everyone's carrying something and dealing with something. And be honest, if the only thing I've got to deal with is infertility, then I'm probably doing all right. And that's something that I've accepted.
It's quite a big cross to bear though, there, mate.
Yeah.
All three of us on this call can say that's a tough one.
It's a huge thing, but what I would say is it doesn't have to define you if you don't want it to. You are who you are in spite of it, not because of it. So look at what you have achieved with it and despite having it. And actually, I think everyone can look in the mirror and say, I've done a fucking good job. So what's the next thing? What's the next thing I'm going to tackle? Because if you can tackle the mental load as a man of having a form of infertility, you know, the world's your oyster.
What you're describing there is like a very high level of acceptance and perception. Like, it's an event. How you choose to define it, you can go various ways. You've chosen to see it in a positive light and to say that it doesn't define you. It's given you extra layers. It's calloused your mind to the life struggles, and that is admirable. And that, like I said, I can't imagine it was like a switch getting there. It would have taken quite some time and a lot of work. But that's ultimately how I moved forward in the end. I was like, look, by choosing to stay in this space of kind of self, I can never say the word, flagellation. Is that the word?
Got there. Yeah.
But I was beating myself up constantly. And I realized that after a while, I was like, I'm not getting anywhere. I'm not progressing anywhere with this. And it was that realizing I had that choice of where to go with this. And it sounds like you had a similar moment.
Yeah, so I mentioned I've got some autoimmune conditions. I've got what's called Addison's disease, so I don't produce any adrenaline. My body attacked my adrenal glands years ago, and they shriveled up and died. So for those who don't know, your adrenal glands sit at the top of your kidneys. I didn't know when I was diagnosed, but it shouldn't be hereditary, but my mum has it as well. And I was diagnosed with that when I was 17, 18. So I went from being fit, healthy, being active, playing tennis 6-7 days a week, to literally not being able to get out of bed, not being able to go to college, not being able to do anything. Now, might sound like a normal teenager behavior, that, but it was actually my body shutting down and the organs starting to go into what's called an Addisonian crisis. But being diagnosed with that when I was, you know, in at the time when a normal teenager would feel invincible. And that was the year I went off to university and all of that stuff. I had some experience with it already. And I remember that I was asked to, a group of friends, and we were all planning a lad's holiday at that time, first lad's holiday away, going to, I think it was Zante at the time. And I actually said that I didn't want to go because I didn't know how I'd cope. I've got to carry an injection kit with me. What happens if I have a crisis? I'm going to be away from a hospital. Da, 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 da. And I let that define me. And it's been since that point that I've said to myself, I don't want anything like that to define me again. So I'd hate for you or listeners to think that I've gone through that process really quickly and it was really easy for me. No, I had to deal with that years ago and I've lived with that for the last 17 years. And when I have something else come like this, it's a case of, okay, I know how to deal with it. I've created that resilience over the years to be able to understand it. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying, Sean. But what I would say is don't beat yourself up as well if you can't deal with it so quickly.
No, no.
So normal.
We're all running our own race at the end of the day, and we have our own paces and we're in our own lanes as well. There's loads of metaphors there. But this is the whole point of the pod. It's sharing the stories of how people have got to certain places and situations and mindsets. And we're in series 5 now, so this will be up into the 50s of episodes. And there'll be things to pick out from many different people. And some of the stuff that, like I've said in the past, people might go on a kind version. Yeah, that's not going to work for me. There's a more extreme version going, yeah, what's he talking about? Load of shit. But it's just us. That's all, is discussing things that might work for us. And for example, like you said, your words were, oh, this doesn't define me. I chose along that similar lines, but to go, do you know what? If this word, azoospermia, it was one that changed my life from the moment I heard it for the first time on the phone. I was like, took a while to get there. I'm talking years, but I ended up going, I'm going to use this. And if it's going to define me, I'm going to define it in a more positive way. So I chose to leverage it that way and thought, I'm going to do something about this. So yeah, we all have different kind of approaches. And that's the beauty of life, is that we're all different. And what we're sharing is all the different ways in which we've found the strength to keep going and to still keep pushing on every day, because you're still living this, and which is why we are so grateful that you're here.
Yeah, so last June, after we'd had a 2.5 failed round, after the frozen transfer didn't work, I'd had very little investigation. So it was, as you always hear, it's always, you produce millions of sperm, ICSI's going to solve the problem, let's focus on getting the right number and quality of eggs. We actually went to see Jonathan Ramsay down in Beaconsfield. The receptionist made a joke that I was the first one through the door that morning and I was the last one to leave, so I had everything done at that point. And all the way through, I'd had a test for single-strand DNA fragmentation. It was Jonathan Ramsay, Professor Ramsay, who was the first one who did double-strand DNA fragmentation tests. So my single strand always came out borderline one way or another, high 20%, low 30% sort of single-strand fragmentation. But it was my double strand that he was the first one to test, and he straight away, he picked it up. We went through a bit of a roller coaster there. So I have history of varicose seals as well. So that was an interesting one. So when I was about 18, 19, I found a lump, as we're all trained to do, check yourself out. I can't say it often enough for people to do that. And I went and got that checked out, and the urologist said, yeah, no, it's what's called a varicose seal. Obviously didn't know anything about it at the time. He said, it's like a varicose vein on your leg, but on your testicles, don't need to worry about it. Won't affect anything. It's just one of those things. It might ache now and again. Okay, fine, cool. Fast forward 15 years from there, you start hearing that actually it could be a problem. But it took Jonathan Ramsay to actually ask about varicose seals and doing research ourselves to realise that it could be an issue. We'd never had any questions asked throughout. Fortunately, unfortunately, it isn't a factor. So I was assessed, had an ultrasound with him, and they were 3 to 4 millimeters. And we were told, whilst it sounds quite big, he said, no, it's absolutely fine. And as a child, I had some trauma to the testicles as well. Jonathan Ramsay once again said, look, very unlikely that's caused, and don't worry about it.
Can I just clarify something? So you were, what, 2.5 cycles in before you were physically examined, even though it had been acknowledged the fact that there was an issue.
Yeah. And we had to go and pay for that privately with Professor Ramsay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still unbelievable, because this happened last year, didn't it? It's not exactly like it didn't happen 15 years ago. It's like you generally think it would be one of the first things they do. Physical examination. They can tell so much just by literally holding your balls in their hands, but it's still not done. And you've mentioned previously that a couple of times that, you know, after your first analysis, there was a confusion with the first sample, so you had to do another one. Did they ever say what the confusion was?
I've been racking my brains about this. So it was a phone call that they said there seemed to be a mix-up and something that wasn't quite right on some of the parameters, and I needed to go and do another sample.
Basically, if we're really kind of open and honest here, they'd picked up that there was an issue, and they just, it was almost like they didn't connect the dot. Like, this is this guy's semen analysis, and we need to look into it further.
I think it sounds to me like they didn't have the bottle to tell him.
Yeah. At the Male Fertility Podcast, we know how powerful the right support can be, which is why we've partnered with Fertility Family to share input. And nutrition matters when it comes to fertility. But let's be honest, maintaining a perfectly balanced diet for conception is incredibly hard. Choosing a supplement can be just as confusing, especially when many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants that can actually harm sperm quality. Impril is different. It's made from activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously been struggling to conceive. Impril is different. It's made using activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously struggled to conceive. What we like is that behind the science at Fertility Family are real stories from real people. To find out more, visit www.fertilityfamily.co.uk. And if you decide it's right for you, our listeners get 10% off using the code MFPOD10. That's MFPOD10. Now, back to the episode. Yeah. Rather than that open and honest conversation from the get-go, that's so, as a man, I would definitely much prefer, even if it's going to be a tough thing to take, you want the honesty.
Tell me.
Yeah, just tell me.
If I know about it, I can deal with it.
So what did they say after the second analysis then?
That was when I was told that the morphology and the motility, and that maybe it wasn't an issue with the first sample.
Did you ever see the first sample and the second sample results together?
I don't think I ever saw them together. So this was all over the phone, and we got the sample results sent across to the clinic, the first clinic we went to from GP. And interestingly, they only sent across the first sample results in the first instance. And I knew that from the date that it had stamped on it. So when we went to the clinic and they said this was the result, I said, oh, it's not the latest one. I think you'll find that there's another one. It was actually slightly worse than the one that you've got there, because I'd made a note of all the parameters when I was told them over the phone. You might want to ask for that, was a statement. And the letter that the clinic then sent to the GP was saying that James has made reference to the fact that there was a second sample almost. Could you send those results across?
It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's basic housekeeping paperwork that. Like, it's unbelievable. But I think Sean put it right there. There was worry about telling you they didn't have the bottle to do it. And maybe it was the individual themselves on the end of that phone, like Sean's experienced this, someone delivering news that doesn't know how to deliver it, doesn't know what it is. And that's one unfair on that individual, but it's also unfair on the person who's just about to receive that news, isn't it? I much prefer a healthcare professional ringing me and having that conversation, because that's what they're trained to do. But yeah, I feel for you, man. When you start connecting all those dots, it must have been a tough discovery.
What I would say is the phone call, I know time slots with GPs and specialists is a premium, but rather than a phone call, having something in person to be able to talk to you, it would make such a difference. It would make you feel like you're being spoken to about your diagnosis, be able to ask some questions rather than a phone call. And there's been a few people on the pod who said that it's been from a nurse or is it a receptionist for yourself, Sean?
Yeah, pretty sure. I don't know, but I can only assume receptionist, member of admin staff, something like that.
It just doesn't give you the confidence that you then want to have to be able to ask questions. You lose that personable influence, that personable connection. And for the healthcare professional to then be able to understand, is this person okay receiving this news? Are they going to be okay, or do we need to give them some support?
Now, you said it perfectly earlier, like you're on the phone and the news you're about to get could change your life. And you actually want to be sat in front of someone that can give you that, like you said, little bit of support, but also the information. Because right then, you get that out-of-body experience, that like white light experience, however you want to kind of explain it, the numbness. You want a few facts. You're not ready to process everything because you're so it's so fresh, but what you want is to know exactly what's happening. And then you can take that away, digest it as you need, and then take the steps that are needed and have that support network in place. Yeah. As we're trying to do with Nexus, you know, that's the whole point of this. But yeah, in-person delivery of bad news like that needs to become more of a regular thing. You're 3 hours away from home, James. That one of the most horrendous drives, if not the most horrendous drive you'll ever have home. Tough one, man. Real tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And it shows your strength of character for receiving that information, taking it on board in whatever respect, like even if it wasn't particularly easy, but you did it, you navigated that journey home and then went and had to face it at home as well, relive it.
What I would say is for anyone who's on the fence or thinks that talking to one of the therapists that's offered is not worth it, I've recently had some therapy around the infertility aspect just to understand it a bit more. And you know what? It's been invaluable. It's not been something because I've been quite open about it, I thought I was dealing with it quite well and I didn't understand the other aspects of it and how it was affecting me. And actually talking to someone who has been through a similar journey, understands what you're going through and can ask you some probing questions to really provoke how you think and how you're dealing with something. It was fantastic.
What's been some of your key learning points from there? And we asked this of another guest, actually. And what were some of the best elements that have happened for you there that you might be able to share with others who can just unlock their own healing, perhaps, or exploration as well?
The big one, and I'll just focus on one. The big one for me was all about blame. I've always blamed myself for the infertility. I've always blamed me for the fact that we weren't able to conceive naturally. You make jokes about it. I always joke that I'm the problem of I'm the one who's got the issue. It was always going to be me. You make jokes with friends and family about it. But actually, that was how I felt underneath the surface of it all. I was the problem. I was the one that was causing us to be in this situation. I was perpetuating this pain. And the reason why I started focusing on that in terms of discussing it with the therapist was from some bits that were said on your podcast by previous guests. And that's what I wanted to explore more because I realized that was what was really causing me not to be able to process it fully. And just talking about it and talking about how you can accept it. You give the example of don't blame a diabetic, type 1 diabetic, for not being able to have a donut and not have insulin. You're in a similar position. The difference is it affects more than just you. But actually, you can process that. You can work with that. You can deal with that.
So how have you, it might still be a work in progress, but where are you at with that blame element? And what has it been that has allowed you to, like you mentioned the word acceptance, to move towards that?
You always want to blame something and be able to put your finger on it because that makes it tangible, that you can feel like you can fix it. And it started at the end of the investigation with Jonathan Ramsey, where ruled out everything that had happened in the past for me, ruled out my Addison's and B12 deficiency and various other bits. And it was at that point that I went, it's happened at some point. I can't put a finger on it. What am I going to do about trying to put a finger on it? Well, nothing. I can't do anything. I've done all the lifestyle changes. 2 years sober, cut out caffeine, limited sugar. Joke at work was alcohol-free, caffeine-free, sugar-free. When did he stop being fun-free? Come on. That is what it is. Rather than looking backwards at what caused it, look forwards at what you're going to do to stop it defining you. And I mentioned on the community get-together on Monday, this year I've started going and watching a sunrise and a sunset each week. No technology, just go, just take a book. I'm reading various things about various aspects of infertility and also more psychology books, learn a bit more about myself and how I deal with things. And it gives you half an hour twice a week where you sit, read, think. It's just taking that little bit of time for yourself to look internally rather than constantly be on the go. And that's really helped me come to terms with just everything myself. And I highly recommend it. I really do. I think I've had two decent sunrises and sunsets this year, and they were great. Just go anywhere with a nice big sky, the beach, the moors, anywhere like that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it sounds like a beautiful thing, that. Good excuse to take the dog out at sunrise, you know? So I might start doing it myself, mate. But we do finish with one question to our guests. And that question this series is, if you could give your younger self one little bit of advice in relation to fertility, what would it be?
Take it seriously. Too many times people assume, I assume, we all get told, it will just happen naturally. My biggest regret from the whole fertility journey was that ostrich moment right at the beginning. I think about that moment every day and that time that was wasted.
You're definitely not being an ostrich anymore, mate.
No.
You are out speaking, and so many people are going to get something from this recording. So thank you so much, my friend.
Great advice. Throughout, like Kieran said, so many people will get so much from this, and we are so grateful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been fantastic. And as I say, I only got onto your podcast 3-4 months ago now, and yeah, I've binge listened to it. So it's been absolutely fantastic. Please keep it up, and the stuff that you're doing with Nexus is fantastic as well.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to talk about in the mailbag, please drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message that comes through. And if you'd like a bit more guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by men who get it. For the latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. Remember, you're not alone.